Accession number 18207, Reel 4.
Tom O'Reilly, Reel 4. You were just telling me about this Leyden incident in December of 1944.
Yeah. yes, it'd been noted that a convoy was coming down from Norway, Denmark, with iron ore, apparently. And we were briefed that there'd be a bullfighter squadron, torpedo-carrying bullfighter squadron, would be making an attack against the convoy, which had then gone into a kind of a harbour by Imoyden, but with a very narrow entrance, apparently, and it was pretty heavily fortified either side. And our task was to dive bomb and more or less create a diversion, kind of draw the flak away from the entrance to this particular harbour, so as enabling the boat fighters to come in, who were coming in off the sea at a very low altitude, with torpedoes to attack this convoy. That's what that entry is about. unfortunately, the boat fighters, they really got a lot of casualties. I think, I don't know what the exact, I think about 75% or 60 to 75% of the attacking boat fighters were actually shot down. Well, you know, down by flak. It was that heavy. But they did hit the convoy. That's what that was about. We'd done a couple of diversionary attacks as well. We attacked a... I think it was some form... where this liquid... some form of liquid gas was being made for the V2s. I remember an isolated dive bombing attack, and this was into a town. It wasn't against the V2s, it was into the town somewhere. And I think it was this, there was two, in fact. One was to a Gestapo headquarters, which we knocked a wall down for Dutch resistance. And that was quite an escape from the Dutch resistance. That was one effort we'd done. And another one, we went after some stuff in a town somewhere.
What do you remember about the attack on the Gestapo headquarters?
Well, we were briefed to attack this headquarters, and there was some form of courtyard, if I recall. I think it was some form of courtyard, and we were to attack, do a low-level bombing attack on this the wall, one side of the wall, you know, flatten the wall. And I think it was quite a big escape took place then.
Do you know where the headquarters was?
Somewhere near Amsterdam, I think. Or would it be The Hague? I'm not sure whether The Hague or Amsterdam. It might have been The Hague.
And how low did you have to go for that?
How?
Low did you have to go for that?
Oh, rooftop for low level. You always did, you know.
What size bombs were you?
There'd be 500 and a 250.
Was it a success?
As far as I'm aware, yeah. We did hit the wall, and there's quite a few of the Dutch lads did get away. Matter of fact, I spoke to the... As I say, we did go over at that particular time when I visited Holland to see John's burial place, and I was introduced to Cohen C. Hamers, as C-O-E-N... H-A-M-E-R-S, Cohen C. Hamer and his wife. And he was the leader of the Dutch syndicate, resistance syndicate, in the Hague area, Muiden area. And he had heard about it, but it wasn't in his area, because I spoke to him about it. And his wife, incidentally, when I visited, and I said I was very privileged meeting him. He'd had the equivalent of the Dutch VC. And his wife, the following day, we went to visit him on the Monday, I think, when we were over there. And on the Wednesday, his wife was going to the Dutch palace to be invested with some form of honour. She was actually the lady who used to take messages from one group to another group and so on from Cohen C. Hamer's place. And they married. They weren't married at the time, but they did marry eventually. And this was a big, I'll always remember, a big metal plaque with on this brass kind of plaque thing. There was an illustration there of a lady on a pushbike looking over her shoulder type of thing, you know. That's why they used to get from one column to another, you know, with messages and stuff. She was going to the Dutch royal family the following day. I was very privileged meeting both of those.
One entry you've put here for the middle of December 44, you put, use the new site, don't like it.
Oh, that was the, was that on Typhoons or was it on Spit still?
Still on Spitfire 16.
Oh, well, it'll be on the Spit. It'll be the, we had a ring and bead initially, and then we went on to a reflector site, right? And then we had this other site that was controlled from your throttle. And the two lateral arms, the idea would be that if you're chasing an aircraft, the two lateral arms, if you manipulated these two lateral arms on your sight to either tip, wing tip of the opposing aircraft and fired, you'd hit it. And you actually moved these two horizontal lines out and in by twisting your throttle, your throttle grip. And of course your bomb release button was in there, of course your firing button was on your control column.
So why didn't you like it?
I never liked the idea because it never seemed to stay still quicker. I used to be all right on deflection. Matter of fact, I used to consider myself, and the rest of the squadron used to consider that I was quite a sharp-eyed character on deflection shooting and the like. And I had quite a reputation for dive bombing as well. The lad thought I was... Matter of fact, one lad visiting the squadron when I was up on 122 squadron, 603 came through then, which was X229 renamed. 603 came through, and I was away in Edinburgh, I think. But he said, he said, one of your lads said he remembered you, and he said, you're a bloody excellent dive bomber, a bloody good, bloody awful formation.
Were you bad at formation flying?
No, I think, I remember who it was. I think I remember one time, I know I'd had quite a few skinfalls, and I seemed to have an awful lot of difficulty this particular day stopping the bloody thing from sliding. You know, you come up, where's your formation, if you're doing formation at all? You come up and you get your wing tip inside his wing tip. Eh? If that's your aircraft and you're formating on him, you get your wing tip just inside his wing tip and in line with the round law. And that's the ideal position, you see. But I could never, this particular day, I can always remember, I could never keep, I was sliding, I was drifting in and sliding out and going up and going down. I was all over the place. I don't know what got into me. I must have had a few skinfalls the night before, but I wasn't particularly on my best mark. And I was formating on him, so he didn't like it all that much.
You said that 603 was the same squadron but renumbered.
Yeah. What happened, 229 squadron came back, you see, as Spitz initially from Malta, from Catania, I should say, in Naples, back to Hornchurch. And we stayed as 229 Squadron. And I think we are still 229 Squadron at the invasion. And then what happened then? The ground crew of 229 We got the ground crew of 603 and 603 got the pilots of 229. Because 603 then, I think they were Mitchells or something like that. I think they're in Bomber Command, I'm not quite sure. But being an auxiliary squadron, normally it should be a fighter squadron auxiliary, being City of Edinburgh. And that's why we as fighters weren't being disbanded, and we'd been earmarked anyway for Spit 16s, which we didn't know were on the way out anyway. And that was our futuristic mark to go after the V2s. So they didn't want to disband us. They wanted us to stay operational. But so they kept 603 ground staff, intermingled them with 229 pilot and aircraft, and called it 603. 603 pilots were kind of posted and dispersed, as was 229 ground staff.
It seems to have happened, according to your logbook, towards the end of December 1944.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. That would be after D-Day, yeah. Yeah.
You put, with 603, for January 1945, you put lost seven bows this trip, very fraught for that, them. That was 17th of January.
That's the one I'm getting mixed up. That's the one that they attacked that harbour, is when they lost. So that's seven bow fighters. I know there was a lot of them. And I know we did do a diversionary attack on that particular operation against the town, so it might not have been could have been to Schelling.
And you've also
have I mentioned to Schelling in there anywhere?
You have a bit earlier in your logbook. What happened at Schelling?
That could have been the town that we dive bombed diversionary.
Well, that
no, it wouldn't have been.
That 16th of July, you've put strafed coastal barges off to Schelling.
Oh, no, that's different, yeah.
Another entry for 1945, this is 3rd of February, you've put old Eric was hit today, shook him first off.
Eric Meader. What happened, Eric? When you let go your bomb, if you're doing a 500 pounder and the 2250s, it doesn't matter, you know, you don't feel them going anyway, but if you let the 500 pound go, you do feel that. And the ideal is that as soon as you press your bomb release, you feel a bump and you move your aircraft back to move it out of the prop, out of the way of the bomb, because the bomb's under your belly, and if you kept it straight, the chances are it could just tip the prop, you see. So as soon as you press it, you'd move your nose up a little bit and you'd feel that bump. And we couldn't see any flak at all. There's none visible. And as we coming away, we were going, this time we were either going to Schelling or Ersel, one of Maldigan or Ersel in Belgium. And Eric called up and I'd been hit. And we didn't see any flak at all. And we thought he's felt the bump and he saw he's been walloped that way. But when all that landed, he had in fact been hit. And he got a shell in the back of his fuselage. Well, he'd been hit with a shell. He hadn't got it there, obviously. And that was his first op, so he got quite an introductory offer from.
What was morale like in general amongst pilots?
No problem.
Did you ever come across this lack of moral fibre business?
No. The only time I felt like, I must confess that at one particular time, that's the thing that kept me in the cockpit, I think, anyway, or that kept my thoughts away from kind of packing it up. We were doing a bomber escort, I think it was, to Hamburg, when we were called to shot, and this was fairly late on, and there was visiting squadrons coming up to visit us. We were going from our squadron, and I think it was either another squadron of Spitz coming up, or two, and a Coltishall. What happened there, it was a round aerodrome with two extensions, which were just about fit three aircraft in good formation, right? And between one extension and the second extension was our dispersal, where our aircraft was and our dispersal hut and things like that. And also there was an underground shelter, which at that time was always covered in grass, quite a mound covered in grass, between them. And these characters were coming in, the windsock was out. That means there was no particular strength of wind at all. So you land down what you call the T. And the T was out, not the windsock. And you always look at your signalling area by flying control. And if the T is out, you land along the long arm of the T in that direction. Failing that, you land according to the windsock. But the T was out. And these lads coming in, if you visit anywhere else, you always put on a good show type of thing, you know. And they were coming in, I think we're coming in. I'm not sure whether they're coming in fours or twos. Must have been twos. No. Must have been fours. If they're coming in the flight formation, that's a four, like a finger four, as they call it. There's your leader, there's your second leader, and there's your third man coming in that way. And as they were coming in, there's our dispersal here and this shelter. And with the tea being out, they should never have done that. If they come in at all, they should have come in pairs and not fours, because there wasn't enough width to get on the extension, and they'd have a long run anyway, but there's no wind. They'd run longer than normal. And we were in. I remember I was on top of a petrol bowser. You know, the petrol bowser is a ladder on the top, and we were sitting on the top of that watching these fellas come round, and a couple of ladders up on the side of the dispersal roof and things like that. As we're watching these things, somebody yells up, and then we see a spit heading straight for us, tail still off the deck, coming straight at us. And he's obviously looking on his forward, not knowing where that he's going. And straight off the bow, so no problem. Some of the lads come off the roof, I think, without any problem. And Andy Cunningham, one of the lads who was in the CO's kite, was right alongside the dispersal. And I was inside cleaning it with the Perspex cleaner. I don't know if you've ever seen this, a purple, deep purple colour. He said, ain't you remember just looking up and seeing this bloody big propeller heading straight for him? He managed to get one leg out the cockpit, getting out, and it runs straight into the CO's kite. Hit the main plane and knocked it, skewed it right round, and he finished up right up against the sandbags and the area with this purple stuff all over his face. Looked a horrible sight. We thought the poor bugger was dead. And as we were watching that, the blood tub came shooting over, and the CO came over, the station commander came shooting over, and the fire tender all came over. And they got to our dispersal when there was another yell come up, and another aircraft was coming in, and it hit this shelter, an underground shelter, and he had a 90-gallon overload tank on him. So it just went up in the air, boof, bloody big bang. And we all inadvertently went racing round there, and I had a bicycle, went round there, and the blood tub was out nearly us, and the fire tender spraying foam all over the cockpit and stuff. Main plane had bounced up and dropped on the cockpit, and the yell give us a hand, we're pulling this stuff off, and the poor lad inside, he'd gone forward as he hit it, and hit his head on the gun sight. Well, spit gun sight, all pig iron, jagged edges there, and he just hit his head. And he made right a mess of the top of his nuts, you know. And with the foam and the bleeding and the burn, it was a horrible bloody sight. And it did turn us a little bit, you know, pull him up. But went the mess afterwards, had our tea, and then we're all waiting to take off, bearing in mind to go on this Hamburg close escort job, bombing job. And an aerodrome at night, it seems to take on a deathly silence, you know. Everything seems to go quiet. And I wouldn't say at night, no, dusk, you know. And we're all waiting for the old cartridge to go from the flying control, you know, to signal, press stitch and get cracking. And at that particular time, while you're waiting there, that spit seemed to take on the shape of a bloody crocodile or something. And if I could have, I thought to myself, what the hell are you doing here, you know? You stupid, call myself all sorts of names for being in there. And if it hadn't been for the... Well, I don't suppose I would have done. But the thought entered my head to say, oh, I've had it, you know, jump out and go do your own fighter escort. But if I hadn't, LMF, you know, hit you in the head and think, you can't do things like that. But I don't suppose I would anyway. I'd have been too ashamed. But that's when the idea... No doubt everybody else on the flight had similar thoughts. We're seeing that lad go for a bit and the state he was in, you know, and then having to take off again and everything so quiet, you know, kind of the peace before the explosion type of thing, you know, and waiting to, the old ex down below waiting for you to give him the thumbs up. He pressed the trolley out and you press your, incidentally, we're not being rude when we say press tits. It used to be, there's two energizers in the spit, and they're just like two little nipples. And it used to be called press tits, you see, so before press tits, waiting to press tits with this fellow and start the engine going. And it became very ominous, the silence and everything else. It gets to you a bit, you know. It got to me a little bit.
What happened on that close escort to Hamburg?
No problem. We saw first time we'd seen a Messerschmitt 163, I think it was a 163 they called it.
A jet?
A jet, yeah. First time we'd seen one. Well, we didn't actually see it. All we saw was a vapour trail. Way above us, just going straight across the sky, like the clapper. And we thought, what the hell is that, you know? It went that quick, you know. And when we got back, we asked the spy, you know, well reported, have you seen it? You know, what the hell was it? And he said, there's a German jet, experimental jet flying around the place. I think that was they were the first. I'm not sure what they were first with, the jets. I'm not sure, the jets.
Yes, they were.
Yeah.
I noticed from your logbook for February and March, even at this late stage of the war, you've still got a number of comrades who've been killed in action.
Yeah.
Like you said, Johnny Green and Saunders.
Johnny Green, Saunders,
and
yeah.
Snowy.
Snowy Wheatley, yeah.
Although he was a prisoner, you thought.
Well, he bailed out. He lobbed down anyway. He bailed out and was taken prisoner eventually. I believe so, anyway. Johnny Green was killed over Holland on the dive bombing. Saunders, he was an Australian lad as well. He went for a bit. And where did he go? I'm not sure. It was Jim Crow.
It was an armed recce.
Armed recce it would be then, yeah. Armed reconnaissance. We're still losing. I think one of the last to go was John Manley. When did he go? Oh, no, it was after that. Because I had left the squad and I volunteered for Typhoons. And
just before we come on to that, you've put for March 1945, I think the 18th or 19th of March, you've put after JU-88 lobbing rockets. He ran for it, couldn't catch him.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
Yeah, there was one with Junkers 88. Remember, there was two or three occasions where he chased in the aircraft.
You mean, when you say lobbing rockets, you mean that he wasn't firing V1s or anything like that?
No. He'd have the ordinary 40-pound warheads. What do you have? What would we have? Were they on Typhoons then? No,
you were still on Spitfire 16.
No, he'd be lobbing the ordinary 40-pound warheads. I think it was I think it was a rocket attack on one of the I think it was might have been a rocket attack on one of the Belgian airfields, either Ursula or Maldigan. I remember we were diverted once coming back from a dive bombing effort, and was it once or twice? It used to happen like that. We used to get radio messages coming back from when we'd been up and hit a target. Especially if it was north of Hagen, coming back to either Ursula or Maldigan. I can never remember. We went to both, but I can't remember why we went to each. What separated one from the other. And on occasion, I know once we were over the... what would that be? I'm not very well up. What's the seafront by the side of the Hague?
The Zuiderzee.
Is it Zuiderzee, is it?
Something. Oh, no, the Hague?
Yeah.
No, that's towards the North Sea, or the river. Yeah, the Hague is near the North Sea.
Yeah, but there's there's kind of estuaries there, isn't there?
Yes.
Yeah. I know we were over there one particular time, and we got diverted to chase an 88 who had gone after something. We were coming back from... It'd be coming back from one of the V2s.
How did you like flying the Typhoon?
The Typhoon was a swine of an aircraft, really. very unpopular. Typhoon was the most difficult aircraft to start I've ever come across. I don't know what possessed me to volunteer for them anyway. I think I got a bit browned off with the 603, the Spitz. Can't quite remember. I'd done the air sea rescue, and I think they asked if anybody would volunteer or want to go into typhoons. And I opened my big mouth and said, yeah, I'd have a go. And I was sent down to Ashton Down. Well, a typhoon, I should say. It had a different method. A Spit and a Hurricane used to be trolley X-started and also a Mustang. But a Typhoon was Kaufman starter, a cartridge starter. And Air Ministry regulation was that you couldn't attempt to start a Typhoon unless you had one of the air standing by with a fire extinguisher in front. And his job basically was to watch the air intake, and if it went on fire, he'd signal way and he'd dive underneath and put the fire out. Because about 4 or 5 times out of 10, the thing would go on fire and wouldn't start. So the system of starting was very, very complicated. To start off with, a Typhoon would frighten anybody. I'd been on Hurricanes and Spits, so I was well seasoned, kind of thing. But some of the lads who went to Ashton Down, when I went down to, were coming straight off OTU onto Typhoons. And it would frighten the life out of them, because they'd be twice the size of a Spitz, a Master, or a Harvard, or anything like that. And to climb into one anyway, the main plane was about this high off the ground. Hang on, if I stood up, it'd be about that high to me, so even higher than that, you know. And you'd have a pressed metal plate on the main plane that you'd push in to get a grip. From the undercarriage, there's the bottom of the fuselage, I should say, you'd have a spring-loaded footrest, which you'd have to pull down from under the undercarriage. It's just to get in the damn thing. And you'd pull yourself up and slide your foot into this spring-loaded footrest under the fuselage. You'd pull yourself up this way and push on your footrest, and slide your hand up the fuselage into another inlet on the side of the fuselage, which you'd grip hold of. That then would enable you to pull yourself up and to put your feet on the main plane. And this was it, just to get in it. Then you'd have to pull yourself over the top and drop yourself down into the cockpit. Now, the Typhoon was overpowered. When you're taxiing a single-engine aircraft, you always had to yaw as you taxied, otherwise you wouldn't see where you were going. You'd taxi in bursts and kick on rudder, and you'd go from side to side so you could see where you're going. With a Typhoon, once you started the engine, it was so, I don't know what the system was, it was so high powered that if you didn't put on a certain thrust of throttle, your manifolds used to oil up and you get black smoke flying out. So the system of taxiing them, you'd be right on as high as you could get your seat. You'd have your goggles down and you'd taxi in bursts. You'd open up, kicking on rudder either side, clear your manifold. By then you're doing about 55, 60 mile an hour. You're going a hell of a belt. You then have to throttle right back, and as you more or less rolled, slowed down as you're rolling, you'd still be yawning left and right. Your manifold would have oiled up then. You'd have the black smoke coming out. You'd have to open up again to clear them again. So you'd go up in bursts up to about 65, 70 mile an hour, and then drop right down to about 35, 30 mile an hour, and then up in bursts again to keep your